Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, I'm Matt Kelly.
And I'm Matt D'Ancona.
And this is the Two Mats for the week ending Friday the 19th of April, the podcast that says 10 years will save the West in 5. That's actually quite good, that, for a change. What did we talk about?
We talked about the smoking ban, and we got very quickly into sort of the broader philosophical nature of it. We were quite...
Yeah,
Socratic and highfalutin this week, weren't we?
We were.
And then we moved on to talk about a wonderful new book by Salman Rushdie.
Yeah, it did. It was a terrifically philosophical conversation.
I thought it was. I think we count ourselves as mature philosophers. So
we do.
It's
indeed.
Completely natural.
There'll be a school.
The two mats.
One day, maybe not. Okay. All right. Anyway, this is the Two Mats, episode 41. Enjoy. So, Matt, big topic this week is smoking.
Smoking ban.
Smoking ban. And we haven't actually talked about it much, so I don't know where I know where I stand on it, but I don't know where you stand.
Well, we went back... I went back and listened to what we said after Rishi's terrible conference speech.
Yeah.
And I think what we said was that it was a sort of... we were both against smoking. It was a slightly idiosyncratic thing to drop into a speech about...
Yes.
HS2 and
yes.
and
it
change.
It seemed random at the time, didn't it?
Well, it was random. But it has indeed proceeded to legislation. So this week, the Commons voted on it, and it was quite a big and intense occasion. And so maybe we could ask producer Matt to give us a blast of one of the nation's favourite authors.
Yes.
The Prime Minister who finished second to a lettuce, Liz Truss, giving her views on smoking bans.
And my real fear is that this is not the final stage that the health police want to push. They are the health police. They are the health police. They want to be able to make their own decisions about what they eat, what they drink, and how they enjoy themselves.
So, I mean, that's Liz Truss. In her uber libertarian mood, basically saying that this new ban, which it's a slightly weird measure, isn't it? I mean, it means that people born in or after 2009 won't be able to legally buy cigarettes.
Yeah.
And for people like Truss, it's the slippery slope to Stalinism and the Gulag, which is a slight overreaction, but there we go. And... it was interesting because, there are lots of ways of looking at it. And I suppose the first thing to get out of the way is the kind of Tory politics of it all. So there was a free vote, which is interesting in itself. 57 Conservatives voted against it, including Kemi Badenoch, Business and Trade Secretary, 5 other ministers. There were 106 abstentions, including Penny Mordaunt and Priti Patel. And I suppose... You know, as we said just now, you know, it's this rather idiosyncratic fixation that Sunak has. He gets fixated, doesn't he, with small boats.
Well, I mean, there's been a lot of conversation around, is this going to be his legacy? Yeah. And, well, I've got some sympathy for that. I'm really conflicted on this because I think he's a complete, total loser. But...
Even a stuck clock tells the right time twice a day.
So what I thought would be... What's interesting for me is the philosophical. So there's two strands, aren't there? There's the political, as you've just touched on, but then there's the philosophical conversation around, is it right to tell people what they can and can't do, and where is the greater good? And I'm fascinated to know where you stand on that.
I totally agree with you. Okay, so just to finish off the Tory stuff, because it kind of gets it. This was basically another drill for the forthcoming Tory leadership contest. I mean, you've got, as I said, Kemi Badenoch voting against it, Suella Braverman and Robert Jenrick, possible candidates, voting against it, and abstentions, Penny Mordaunt, Priti Patel. They're both, what they're doing is gesturing support, pain-free, because they knew that Labour would get the vote through, and they did, to the Conservative Libertarian base. And, you know, the kind of Tory members who still harumph a bit about safety belts and fire hydrants.
Are there still Tory people who harumph about safety belts?
I mean, they harumph about everything, every encroachment upon their lives, their land, you know. And sort of have that 20th century formation of the Tory mindset, which is that, you know, to be a conservative is to oppose the encroachments of the state.
Yeah.
And that's still how most members, we're not talking about Tory voters here, but, you know, how members see the state as a bad thing, you know, except when it's giving them their pensions and when they need the NHS and all the rest of it.
Tax breaks,
And their tax breaks, exactly. Yeah. But I mean, in this respect, it's just all part of the long death rattle of this government. You know, the Tory party's disaggregating. But then to your point, I think it's actually a sort of micro case of a huge debate that we're going to be having a lot.
Yes.
Which is about about government and freedom and the tensions between them. And this is the key, I think, the challenges of this century.
Yes. Right. Well, so let's pause there for a
second.
That's
the sort of framing of it.
Do you agree with the ban?
Yes, in the sense that I agree with the ban, but only as part of a much bigger suite of measures to stop smoking.
Right.
You know, I mean, I think it's a very odd way of doing it, which is, I mean, Badenoch's sort of the pretext she offered for voting against was you're going to have two categories of adult.
Yeah.
You know, those born after 2009 won't be able to go into a tobacconist and buy, you know, 20 JPS. Those who were born before will.
Like a day before.
Which is obviously ridiculous. Now,
But well, on that point, I kind of think that the reality of what they're saying, which is that smoking is unique because it's really harmful without redemption, without mitigation.
Yes.
There's no upside to it. So in that regard, it's not quite like drinking. But we can talk about drinking.
Yes. Later.
We can talk about eating, you know, crap food and stuff
skiing
like this.
And...
But so there's no upside to smoking. But it is addictive. So the way the law's been framed, or the solution to getting people stopping, has been framed like that in recognition that it's much harder to do something about it if you are a smoker.
That's true.
So they're saying, you're a smoker now.
That is the best argument for it.
But doesn't that define the unique problem about smoking?
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
The least impressive argument is the one that Truss and others have been making, which is, it's a slippery slope, right? Well, look, every policy is a slippery slope in the sense that you could go further.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what government is. You.
Well, shipping people off to Rwanda is a bit of a slippery slope as well.
Well, it's a slope on which no one is moving. We're just spending a lot of money. It's a silly argument. And the other thing that I think is worth pointing out is that smoking, contrary to a lot of prediction, measures against smoking are working. 20% of the population used to smoke as recently as 2011, right?
Yeah.
And now it's down to 13.
Yeah.
Now that shows you that the various, you know, the sort of essentially ostracizing of smokers and other, they are having an effect.
Does that include vapes, that kind of statistic?
No, and of course that's a separate thing. And it's worth mentioning the fact that this is not the only measure in that legislation, but it's still causing about 80,000 deaths a year in the UK. It is, in terms of preventable illness, by far the biggest cost for the NHS. About 17 billion a year is the estimate. And smoking rates amongst older teens are still high, apparently about 12%, which is 16 to 17 year olds. That's high. That's high.
That is high. Yeah.
And the point you made, Matt, I think is where we really hit the bone, which is it is unbelievably addictive.
Yeah.
Nicotine. I mean,
have you ever smoked?
No.
Right.
But as you know, I stopped drinking 20 years ago. Yeah. Now, you know, I've spoken to a lot of people who've stopped drinking and found it relatively easy.
Yeah.
But I know a lot of them have struggled over very long periods of sobriety to stop smoking.
I started smoking when I was 14 by the news agents in Hightown in where I grew up in Merseyside, who used to sell what was called a Lucy for 10 pence, which was a loose cigarette and a match.
Right.
One match.
Just one.
And if it was rainy and blowy.
And the match.
Yeah. If it was rainy and blowy and you didn't light the fag with the match, he was very grumpy about giving you a second one.
Yeah.
So, and then I went to work, obviously, and I used to sit opposite, right next to a guy called Sid Dye, who, brilliant, brilliant journalist, who I'm pretty sure is dead now. But, and Sid had like really, you know, not emphysema, but he had like dodgy lungs. Mm. And we used to, the whole office would sit there smoking around Sid, and he'd moan about it. And you know, and it was just like, oh, shut up, Sid, you know. And the walls of the office would be like a shade of nicotine yellow. And then I remember when the band came in, having to smoke in a little cupboard about the size of this.
Well, the first
studio,
thing was smoking rooms, wasn't
That's
it?
That's right, smoking rooms, which reeked of smoke, obviously, and it intensified the... You used to walk around stinking of stale smoke, you know.
Yeah.
And then I gave up. I've given up twice, which, if that's not an oxymoron, but I've given up twice in my life. And it's so easy to slip back in, that nicotine and the whole thing. And it was, the truth is, it was James Dean that made me a smoker.
Because, I mean, look, you know, and I say this as a non-smoker, in culture, you know, smoking can look incredibly cool.
Yeah,
that's the problem with it.
Totally.
And people who smoke tell me that, you know, they don't really get going until they've had that first nicotine hit of the day.
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, you know, what's interesting, I mean, to talk about the difference with drinking, because people immediately move to drinking and say, oh, you want to prohibit, you know, prohibition. No, I don't at all, because I don't know many moderate smokers.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I know the vast majority of people I know who drink are, you know, moderate drinkers and fit of one sort or another, and can cut back, or, you know, they let themselves go a bit over Christmas or whatever, but I don't know any. I've never met a moderate smoker.
No. When we talk about the conversation about the prohibition of dangerous things,
yes,
there's loads of dangerous things. We all
skiing.
Well, I'll give you an example. I used to be really into motorbikes,
right?
And got more and more obsessed with motorbikes, and started doing more and more track days and stuff like this, and riding hugely powerful machines, and had a couple of friends who died, and all, you know, so I was went to the Isle of Man TT a couple of times, you know, watched that, incredible. When my youngest child now was born, I looked myself in the mirror and I thought, I cannot responsibly carry on doing this. And I stopped riding my motorbike that day. Now, the difference between riding a motorbike, which is inherently dangerous to me and not harmful to anybody else, and smoking, is that you can make the decision to stop riding it. The motorbike doesn't turn up the next morning saying, ride me, ride me, ride me. You know,
no one offers you a motorbike in the pub, do they?
No, that's right.
They don't come to you and say, do you want to go outside and ride a motorbike?
There's no motorbike patch. You don't need one. You know, it's...
you fancy a Harley.
That's
no one says that.
That's right. But smoking's different. Smoking is different. I do get the logic behind the way they're going about it.
It's and specifically in the health service, and we've talked about this before, you know, the costs that are heading towards the NHS, let alone now, you know, where it is scandalously underfunded, but in the future, as people live longer and so on, and medicine gets more elaborate and more diseases can be treated, but over a long period of time, the costs heading towards the NHS are stupendously high.
Yeah.
And every government I can remember has said we must do more preventive medicine, we must do more preventive measures. Well, it really is time now to take that seriously. And part of that is, I think, effectively banning smoking.
Yeah.
But
would you ban it for everybody?
I think what you said earlier about the difficulty of banning it for people who are already smoking is a very good point.
Do you know the other thing that I think? So smoke, let's take it, let's look from the point of view of a smoker now as well.
Yes.
Okay. Do you know how much cigarettes are these days? 15, 16 quid.
Quid a packet. Yeah.
I mean, so it's costing the average smoker 2,000 quid to smoke.
Wow.
And the you know, obviously the rationale behind the inordinate tax is that you've got to mitigate somehow the cost to the NHS and also there's loads of other costs, lost productivity, and it's somewhere between 10 and 20 billion, right, people would say, the cost to the UK.
Yeah.
But if you accept that it's an addiction and it's hard to get off, you could prescribe cigarettes to current smokers. And say, okay, but no more, you know, they're the only, you have to get them through the NHS.
Make them, so they become like methadone.
They become like methadone.
Yes.
You know, and then you wean people off. And yes. I know that all this sounds very paternalistic, but I do think that if you asked most smokers, would they like to give up? They'd say yes.
I think we have to wean ourselves off the word paternalistic.
Right.
And we have to wean ourselves off the words nanny state.
Yeah.
You know, because it's sort of reflexive now. You know, there are all these things. I mean, we talked a couple of times on the podcast about ultra-processed foods and, you know, refined sugars and things like that. And there's no doubt that we need radical measures in that area. Now, is it taxation? Is it regulation? I don't know.
Yeah,
I'm not educated enough on that particular field. But I do know we're going to have to take those measures. And if every time one of those measures is taken, there's a sort of, you know, cordon around it of, oh, you can't do that because it's nanny state paternalistic. The problems of the 21st century are... they all involve government doing more big stuff that won't suit libertarians. You know, it is sort of things like climate change, people living longer and health issues, management of population, mobility, regulation of a tech revolution that's moving at light speed.
Yeah.
Inequality that is now threatening the social fabric. You know, it's so bad. Global insecurity. I mean, the list goes on. All those things are going to, talking about rolling back the frontiers of the state, as Thatcher did, in this context, the 2020s, it just sounds silly.
Yes, I agree.
And yet, that is what a lot of right wingers are still doing.
Yeah.
So, you know, what's going on here, I think, to sort of try and mesh the philosophical and the political, I think there is a legitimate folklore memory of the 20th century, which was, it is, you know, amongst older people of by which I mean people in their 40s and above, or let's say, which is a memory of totalitarianism and its consequences, you know, and a kind of retreat from anything that has that whiff.
Mm-hmm.
But I actually think the thing that's really weaponizing this now is COVID, because on the right now, the pandemic around the world, not just here, the pandemic is sort of seen as a drill for an overmighty state surveilling us, recording everything digitally, you know, slowly introducing authoritarian measures, that lockdown and the vaccine rules and the masks were all just prep.
Yeah.
And that argument, which during the pandemic was only made by crazy people, is now being made by a lot of people, and it's distorting the argument. I was very interested that Chris Whitty, the chief medical officer, was sent out to defend this legislation on the Today programme, and I think he wrote a piece in The Guardian, anyway, to do the media.
Yeah.
And his points were very well made. But I also thought, I wonder how triggering this is for a lot of people who think, Christ, you know, it's Mr. COVID. Dr. COVID's back to tell us what to do.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was doing his job. He's the CMO for England. You know, he should be doing that. That's fine. But I do think that COVID plays a really big part. I think it plays a big part in politics generally, actually.
But it's lodged in people's heads.
It's lodged in people's
heads.
And you can see it in the media, you know, the way that the Telegraph presented the lockdown files. You know, their position now is that lockdown wasn't necessary. Rishi was a hero because
he was fighting it.
Yeah. You know, it bankrupted the economy. It didn't quite, but you know, furlough was a waste of money. The keeping of kids away from school was lunatic because kids didn't really suffer it very badly, etc., etc. So everything now, there's a very, very hardened school of opinion on the right, on both sides of the Atlantic, that, you know, COVID was linked to, and it gets very conspiratorial and anti-Semitic mentions of George Soros and Bill Gates. You know the kind of memes in this. But it is very strong, and it's virally, not to pun, but you know it has become very embedded in right of center thinking, and not just sort of MAGA thinking, but right wing people generally.
I wonder whether with the particular issue of smoking, though, that they've picked the wrong fight, because
yes,
there's been a lot of surveys in red wall seats expecting to hear that kind of, can't they just leave us alone, you know, smoke, you know, the old John Reed kind of,
yeah,
you know, what,
fighting the fag, and
yeah, exactly, why would you deprive us of the few pleasures we've got? And actually the truth is that when asked, most people will say absolutely, it's a filthy habit, costs loads of money, crippling the NHS, ban it now, you know. So
social norms do change.
Maybe they've picked the wrong battle with smoking.
I think that's right. And I also think that, I mean, to look at it in a slight, frame it slightly more optimistically than I just did, I think there's a big split in the global populist nativist right on this, actually. Because I think people like Donald Trump and Boris Johnson, they want government to do stuff, big stuff, that's not the kind of stuff we might want, you know, like more the NHS or, but, you know, the kind of stuff that suits them, building walls, targeting welfare at their base voters, what Johnson called levelling up, and hasn't happened. But, you know, he wanted to do it. And then there's a wing of the populist movement that cares almost pathologically about liberty.
Yeah.
So this week, Javier Milei, the president of Argentina, was interviewed by little Ben Shapiro.
Yeah.
One of our, who we saw at the end too. And he is very small.
Very small. Very impressive in his own way.
In a tiny, teeny, tiny little way. Yeah. And what was interesting was Milei was not in crazy loco mode. He was in I'm an economist mode. And he was very articulate and interesting. But he is so libertarian. I mean, you know, it was Friedrich Hayek. It was Milton Friedman. You know, he's already abolished 10 ministries, and he wants to introduce another 2,000 measures into the Argentinian Congress, you know, further reducing the size of government. Now, yeah, you can say that's an outlier case, but a lot of right-wing people in this world do think that you know, the task of any conservative government is to make government smaller.
Yeah, and also, it could, you know, we had an IMF, we're recording this on Thursday, and the splash in the FT this morning was about the IMF warning Sunak to rein in the gap between spending and revenues.
Absolutely.
And we are a much poorer country than we like to
think.
You know, obviously Brexit has contributed to this, COVID, a number of other things, but that structural idea that we are, that Britain is like, I know we keep saying, oh, we're the sixth biggest economy in the world and all of this business, but we're not a country that can have roads like they do in France. We're not a country that can have a health system like they do in Sweden. You know, we are very much confined by shrinking, diminishing resources, money resources.
Yeah.
I think
we both agree that, you know, until we get back at minimum into some relationship with the single market, that is going to remain true.
Just one thought before we go for a break about, you know, this whole, again, just looking at the bigger picture and the philosophy of bans.
Yes.
Can you think of a single ban that a government's brought in, you know, highly contentious issue, and they've got it over the line, that anybody's ever gone back and repealed?
It's a very interesting question. I mean, obviously in America, the
Road
v. Yeah, Road v. Wade. But I mean, some bans have faltered, haven't they? The dangerous dogs issue is a good example of that, something that was rushed.
Yes.
But generally speaking, and of course this is what libertarians always argue, is that no one ever hands liberty back. Yeah. And I think one of the tasks of the new government, assuming there is a new government, is going to have to be, and again, you know, this is to a challenge for Keir Starmer and his colleagues, which is, how do you frame the reality that there is going to need to be more smarter government without appearing authoritarian yourself? Because, you know, the Tories, whatever form they take after the election, assuming they're in opposition, will be longing to pounce on nanny state, you know, paternalist going back to, you know, the worst of Labour. And I think that Starmer's got to think of some robust rhetoric and thinking that says, no, you know, this is not ideology. This is a response to the needs of the 21st century.
Yeah.
This is actually pragmatic. You know, this is not an attack on people's individual liberty for the sake of it.
Yeah. Shall we also just say the unsayable, which is that it's entirely possible, there's a grave danger that in 20 years' time, Rishi Sunak might be remembered for doing something positive.
Yes. Well, I mean, I assume, I always assume that one of the reasons he's against smoking is because people of his wealth and background don't like smoking. You know, they like microdosing at Stanford Business School, you know, and arguing about...
I'd be well up for that.
Well,
would you?
I don't know. I think I'm not really, you know, I lead a sheltered life. but I mean, I think for him, there's something gross and non-you and common and, you know, about smoking.
Yeah, yeah.
However, who cares? Because you're right. I mean, it might well be that by accident, in the even as bits of red hot engine casing were flying across the Tory chain, you know, he might accidentally have got something right.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, let's hope so. Let's hope so.
I hope so. You know, I think it's a good thing. And I think that, you know, I particularly like the idea, particularly of kids not being able to smoke. I mean, I'm also powerfully aware that kids are amazingly resourceful.
Yes.
Right?
That's right. And we'll find a way.
And, you know, if ever there's a demographic that we'll find a way of getting hold of. Yeah. Tabs and, you know, whatever.
Definitely.
It'll be them. But fantastic. You can but try.
You can but try. And so great conversation. We're going to come back in the second half and have a chat about a genuinely...
A proper author.
A proper author. Not Liz Truss.
Not Liz
Truss. Proper author. So join us in the second half any minute now.
The BAFTA TV Awards with P&O Cruisers are on their way. And in this series of Countdown to the BAFTAs, I'm going to be assembling a top panel of TV experts and stars to discover exactly what it takes to become a BAFTA-nominated TV production. As well as that, we're going to be taking you behind the scenes of the BAFTA TV Craft Awards to meet the talented crew, writers and directors who make some of your favourite TV shows. That's Countdown to the BAFTAs with me, Alex Zane. Find us wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to tune in on May the 12th on BBC One and iPlayer to discover the winners.
This podcast, as ever, is brought to you by The New European. You like The New European, Matt, don't you?
I revere it.
You revere it, quite right, because you're in it every week.
I've revered it long before that.
In the company of many other brilliant, brilliant writers.
Whom I revere.
Yeah, and anyway, you can join The New European. If you like the content of this podcast, you will love The New European. And I've got a special offer just for listeners to the two Mats. You can sign up from as little as £1 a week and get full access to our online newspaper, our brilliant new app, which we've just relaunched. You can download every edition we've published since the Brexit referendum in 2016. You get audio reads from Alistair Campbell reading out his diary too. You get the ability to comment. There's daily interactive puzzles. People love the puzzles almost as much as they love your column, Matt.
I can't comment.
And you get...
I'm busy with my Sudoku over here.
And for an extra pound a week, you can get the actual newspaper delivered to you every week, which is more than a 75% saving on the cover price you pay at the newsagent. So subscribing is the best way to support us. And to tip you over the line, if you're thinking about subscribing to The New European, I'm going to offer everybody a free copy of James O'Brien's brilliant book, How They Broke Britain, which is a terrific read. And it's signed by the author, and that's worth £20. So you get £20's worth of James O'Brien hardback when you subscribe to The New European from just £1 a week. Go to theneweuropean.co.uk/2mats. There's a link in the show notes. You won't regret it.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
So, Matt, you have the book in front of you.
I do.
What are we going to talk about?
Well, although it is depressing that when I checked this morning, recording this on Thursday, Liz Truss was at number 6 in the Amazon chart.
No, really?
Yeah, I'm afraid so. There is no doubt what the book of the week and I'm sure one of my books of the year will be, which I, you know, more or less in one sitting, which is Salman Rushdie's Knife, which, as people may know, it's a funny thing because it's a book he absolutely didn't want to write, but it's fantastic that he was able to write it.
Yeah.
Because, as we know, he was brutally attacked on stage at an event in August 2022 in Chautauqua in upstate New York. And in 27 seconds, he was stabbed approximately 15 times. And this is a 75-year-old sort of literary legend confronting a 24-year-old attacker.
27 seconds sounds like it's quick, but I did think we should do 27 seconds of silence, but then people would switch off. But I do recommend people look at a clock, go for 20, and imagine yourself being stabbed through
Anderson
the duration.
Cooper did exactly that in his interview with Rushdie, and it was amazing. It felt like an eternity.
Who does that?
Anderson Cooper in his 60 Minutes interview.
He does pause
he
for 27
exactly
seconds.
That,
great.
And it is a very long time. How did this all come about? Well, you know, most people will know, but for those that don't, in 1989, Rushdie published a book called The Satanic Verses, which is actually one of his weird magic realist novels. It's 600 pages long. I like Rushdie's writing very much, but the Ayatollah Khomeini or his advisors didn't. And he passed a death sentence, a fatwa, on Rushdie, which led to him living in hiding for almost a decade. And there were at least 6 state-sponsored assassination plots intercepted. The Japanese translator of the Satanic Verses was assassinated in 92. The Norwegian publisher narrowly escaped the same fate the year after. And then in 98, the Iranian government, after much diplomacy with the UK, declared itself, they didn't get rid of the fatwa, but they declared it themselves agnostic on the fatwa. And Rushdie sort of slowly emerged back into the light, if you like.
Yeah.
He moves to New York and suddenly finds that he's able to lead a relatively normal life and lived in public.
You know?
But unfortunately, the murderous impulse had not been defeated. It was just slumbering. And this was this gruesome attack in 2022. And you know, as he says in the book, it was touch and go. He very nearly died.
I've got something in common with the attempted assassin in that I too only read a couple of pages of Satanic Verses, but I managed to contain my homicidal urges having read those pages. And it just feels like I can't understand whether this guy is driven by that fatwa or is just mentally ill, you know.
Well, one of the most interesting sections of the book is that he describes his language as his knife, metaphorically. And he imagines a dialogue with his attacker, whom he refuses to call by name. His trial has been postponed while there's all this fuss over the book at the request of his attorneys. But in the book, Rushdie imagines a dialogue with this guy. This was a guy who was very lonely, lived in his basement for 4 years playing video games, went to the Lebanon and found himself masculinized and radicalized. He'd been surrounded by women in his house, his mother and his sisters, and went to see his father in Lebanon and clearly discovered, as is often the way in radicalizing and grooming that goes with it, the sort of the maleness, the patriarchal dimension of fundamentalist violence.
Right.
I mean, this is all a matter of record. So I think Rushdie was onto something in that speculation. And also what is almost invariably the case is in the sort of the terrorist profile, the psychological profile, is some sort of difficulty with sex and women.
Right. This is what, incel kind of thing?
They're basically jihadi incels.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's hit the way he looks at it. But I mean, another thing to mention is it's very unexpectedly, it's a love story because he married a poet and novelist called Rachel Eliza Griffiths in 2021, but very quietly because his private life had been the subject of much publicity and speculation. And he decided that they would have a quite quiet life together.
But I love the story about when they met.
He met
at a party, but he walked into a window.
And it was one of those sort of, it was like a rom-com moment, you know, and they've never been apart. But, you know, he realised, I think initially he was worried he wouldn't be able to write at all. But when he started thinking, what do I want to write about? He realised that there was no way he was going to be able to get to the other side and write novels again until he'd addressed the elephant in the room, which he calls a fucking enormous mastodon in my workroom, waving its trunk and snorting and stinking quite a bit, which I think is brilliant. Yeah. But he also says, to write would be my way of owning what had happened, taking charge of it, making it mine, refusing to be a mere victim. I would answer violence with art.
Mm.
And then, of course, he moves on, I think slightly wearily, but with acceptance that this is his part of his role historically, to the whole question of being a free speech champion. Yeah. He says that he sort of had to accept that fortune has turned me into a sort of virtuous, liberty-loving Barbie doll, which is a wonderful...
Yeah.
And also records his concern, I think he's right, and I'm quoting him again, progressives had started backing away from freedom towards new definitions of the social good, according to which people would no longer be entitled to dispute the new norms. Protecting the rights and sensibilities of groups perceived as vulnerable would take precedence over freedom of speech. And we've discussed this before on the podcast, but I think he's absolutely right.
Yeah.
And I think that the proof of the pudding really is, there are all sorts of incidents that have demonstrated this, but the kind of QED is, does anyone seriously think that a mainstream publisher would publish the Stanek verses today?
No, not a cat in hell's chance. Not a cat in hell's chance.
Which, if you think about it, is kind of very sad.
Yeah, yeah. And it's particular to Islam as well, isn't it? It's the religion that people are scared of broaching.
Yes, that's right. And the very good writer, Kenan Malik, he has said that we've internalized the fatwa.
Mm.
And this has sort of infected the culture because, you know, 2015, there was the Charlie Hebdo massacre in Paris. And I think 12 people were brutally assassinated, more injured. And in that year, PEN America, you know, which is the great writers organization in America, decided to award the magazine Charlie Hebdo, a satirical magazine, the Freedom of Expression Courage Award. And I remember this, you know, and Rushdie mentions it in the book, 242 writers in America and elsewhere wrote to PEN America complaining, saying about the award, saying, obviously, killing people in magazines very bad.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for that. Yeah. You know, but, you know, the images, the cartoons that they'd published about Islam had been offensive.
You're joking.
And therefore, it shouldn't, you know, it was wrong of PEN to reward it. Now,
So these are 240 writers.
Yes. These are PEN members, and some of them quite distinguished, like Teju Cole, saying that shouldn't have happened.
Wow.
And I think that was a kind of, you know, inflection point, really.
Yeah.
Because it showed you where the cultural center of gravity had shifted to, which is, I think the Rushdie affair has had a huge impact upon publishing, upon fiction. I think it has dovetailed with social justice movements. And as a consequence, and there are glorious exceptions to this, but I think today's literary fiction tends to be rather cramped and constrained and well-behaved and, you know...
Inoffensive, basically.
Inoffensive. Yeah. And, you know, it is, I find, absolutely ridiculous.
It's almost a progenitor to the whole culture war that we're now existing.
You know, but I find it absolutely ridiculous.
The right to offend.
That, you know, and I've written three very undistinguished novels, but, you know... I don't really want to write anymore at the
moment. They weren't offensive enough. That's a problem. Piss enough off.
Probably true. But if I did now, they would be read by sensitivity readers.
Yeah.
You know, and
I was told this, that prospective novels now go before people who will say, you can't say, you know, all the things we see on social media, you can't say this because you're appropriating that character's ethnicity.
I know this from direct experience in other contexts. This is absolutely true.
Yeah.
And the other thing that I think is, and is often the case in fiction publishing now, is that authors are told to, quote, stay in their lane. So they can only write about their own
genres.
Well, not just genre, but their own background, their own
white male,
identity.
Liverpool,
right,
you know,
right, yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Which, of course, is, you only have to think about it for 2 seconds, is basically abolishing fiction.
Yes.
Because the whole point of fiction is to imagine yourself.
Yeah.
I mean, one of its great functions is to imagine yourself in someone else's shoes.
Well, it's the death of science fiction for a start, isn't it?
It's the death of science fiction.
Or maybe the science fiction's the safe place because it doesn't
exist.
Maybe
science fiction is the safe place, but who knows? But I think there's a real danger in this, that the civic task of the novelist is being, it used to be a kind of intellectual and imaginative provocateur.
Yeah,
and now it's to be a kind of emotional support provider.
Yeah.
He says, Rushdie, this is going back to what he writes, he says, art challenges orthodoxy. Art knows that received ideas are the enemies of art. Clichés are received ideas, and so are ideologies, both those which depend on the sanction of invisible sky gods and those which do not. Without art, our ability to think, to see freshly, and to renew our world would wither and die. And then he says, to sort of bring it back to his case, art is not a luxury. It stands at the essence of our humanity, and it asks for no special protection except the right to exist. It accepts argument, criticism, even rejection. It does not accept violence. Pretty good, isn't it?
Yeah, that's good.
I mean, you know, I hope that loads of people around the world will read this book and think again about the idea that it's the most important thing is that we don't give offence.
I think the most amazing thing about this book is that he managed to write it at all.
It's extraordinary.
So soon after, I mean, we've all been in situations, I remember having a gun pointed at me in South Africa and having PTSD about it in a mild form for quite some time. He was nearly stabbed to death, lost an eye in this attack, in 15 stab wounds to his
body, and it goes
thrown, slashed.
The book
goes
into, you know, absolutely necessarily, and good for him, grueling detail about the surgeries that followed,
long
weeks of rehabilitation. You know,
I just hope that he's as well as he seems to be with that. You saw the Anderson Cooper interview.
Yes.
I saw the Alan Yentob interview. It's on iPlayer. It's only 10 minutes.
It's well worth seeing.
It's well worth seeing. And also his wife seems absolutely brilliant. You know?
I think that's why I said it's a love story. You know, the part of the magic that got him back was
But it's only,
love.
What is it, 2 years ago?
August 2022. So it's less than 2 years.
I mean, he must have the most incredible mental strength to be able to compose
himself
like that.
Well, it's very interesting. There's it is very moving as a book.
Yeah.
There's a very moving section on Martin Amis, who of course died last year, and about him going to see Amis, as Amis was clearly, you know, suffering very badly from what became terminal cancer, and they exchange emails which in the end are sort of valedictory, you know, and he reproduces some of them, and one of the things that is, you know, really is a proper lump in the throat stuff, is that Amis praises him because he says that when he saw Rushdie coming into the room for dinner, he realised that the phrase is that Rushdie had been equal to it.
Right.
That the challenge had been made by a global theocratic, fascistic ideology represented by a sad, lonely 24-year-old.
Yeah.
And Rushdie had been taken to the very brink of death.
Yes.
And he had stood his ground, metaphorically.
Yes.
And the thing that courses through the book, as it does through his fiction, is this kind of hunger for life.
Uh-huh.
You know, because, look, magic realism is not to everyone's taste, right? He would be the last person on earth. I mean, he likes people reading and buying his books, but it's not for everyone. But what he is all about is that his books are a kind of torrent of life and vigor and cultures colliding and converging and talking to each other. And, you know, it's... I think Midnight's Children, which I suspect will be the book he's remembered for, which he won the Booker for and then the Booker of Bookers, is sort of a manual to 21st century living, because it's all about the mishmash of modernity. It's all about how things, you know, there is no such thing as purism. That everything is ironic and can, you know, congealing and mixing and,
yeah,
you know,
chaotic, that, and
chaotic messy, exactly. Yeah, and the glory of the modern world is precisely in that.
Yeah.
And, you know, the battle is therefore between those who embrace that and those who hate it because they want a monoculturalism, monotheism, religious fanaticism. You know, we're seeing it in America. I mean, the sort of absurdity of a man of Donald Trump's morals being, you know, beholden to people who literally believe that, I mean, a lot of them, interestingly, have been arguing in the last couple of months that the war in Gaza is the start of the second coming.
Oh, my God.
That, you know, we're reaching the end of days.
Oh,
so,
God.
You know, you know, fundamentalist Islam is...
I mean, we might be reaching the end of days, but I'm not expecting a visitation from above.
I mean, you know, fundamentalist Islam is undoubtedly the one that is sort of at the moment, you know, has been for quite a while now, the cause of, you know, immediate terror attacks. But if you want to look at the sort of influence fundamentalist Christianity in the States and indeed in Russia.
Yeah.
You know, Putin has embraced a very, very nasty version of Orthodox Christianity there.
Which is the weirdest thing, isn't it?
Absolutely. But I mean, you know, the hatred of LGBT people, you know, the hatred of women, hatred of, you know, reproductive freedom and so on and so on.
Yeah.
There is a sort of Gileadization.
And all tied in with a peculiar nationalism as well.
And it always ties in, you know, it's that nationalism plus fanatical religion equals, you know, the threat.
My God, and it is a threat.
But of that book, just to conclude, one thing just to say about it is that I was very moved by it, but also incredibly cheered, because if Salman Rushdie, aged 76, having been stabbed 15 times and come back, can be cheerful, the rest of us can too.
Great.
It's a book of great optimism.
Great thought to end.
You know,
this
he calls it something like it's something like wounded happiness. It's a wonderful phrase.
Yeah,
it's good, isn't it?
Well, as the late great Ernest Hemingway said, he said, "Life breaks everybody, but some grow stronger at the places where they break."
And so it seems.
Thank you for that, Matt. Brilliant.
Be more Rushdie is my slogan.
Be more Rushdie. Be more Salman. Great. As ever, folks, get your questions in and any feedback to 2matts@tnepublishing.com. That's the number 2, M-A-T-T-S, at tnepublishing.com. We had a full postbag after our trans podcast last week. It was very good. Thank you for all those messages. If you listen on Spotify, you can message us there. And that's what John Lane did, who said, "A grateful thanks for the weekly culture email. I really missed Matt's recommendations every week when he left Tortoise. So it's great to have them back again. And Civil War is..." I don't know. Asterisked out there. I don't know. Is... what? Oh! This, just to explain, dear listeners, there's 5 asterisks on my thing. So I was
thought it was an expletive.
Civil War is shite? What is it? But no, Civil War is 5 stars.
It is very
okay.
Good.
Thank you for that. Thank you for that, John Lane. You did enjoy Civil War, didn't you?
I loved it. Yeah, I think I
might go and see it at the weekend.
I really can't recommend it highly enough. It's terrific.
Brilliant. Many more questions on our regular Sunday Q&A coming up in a couple of days' time. Please remember our subscription offer. Head to theneweuropean.co.uk/2Matts. There is a link in the show notes and it's the best subscription offer available, so don't hesitate, just jump on in. Thanks as ever to producer Matt Hill at Rethink Audio, with support from Ollie Peart. And until next week,
it's goodbye from me.
It's goodbye from him. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, Monday is the anniversary of the day a much-loved entertainer died on live TV.
Then on Tuesday, we remember the Roots sensation of 1977.
On Wednesday, we unearth the bizarre story of the longest war you've never heard of.
On Thursday, the day an Italian became Queen of Poland.
And on Friday, we celebrate the women who infiltrated the men-only Boston Marathon.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the Retrospectors. 10 minutes each weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing.
Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.